Okay, I think we're all set. Okay, we're here today with Bruce Hartford at the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's 50th anniversary. And Bruce is here to, Mr. Hartford is here to share his story with us about his experience growing up and becoming involved with the civil rights movement. So one of the first questions that we want to start off with, just tell us a little bit about yourself, your name, birth date, and age.
Bruce Hartford, January 15, 1944, which would make me 66.
Okay.
I was born at a very young age.
We all were.
Just a mere baby.
We all were, all right. So where were you born?
Well, I was born in Chicago, but I grew up in Los Angeles.
Okay. And you were both parents, raised by both parents?
Yeah.
Oh, what? Talk a little bit about your childhood. What are you...
Okay, well, okay, see, here we go. My parents were communists.
Wow.
They were labor organizers, CIO organizers, and they had been working unions, and they continued to do that until the red baiting, the McCarthy hysteria. They were hounded by the FBI, called up before committees. They were fired from their jobs and so forth. I grew up in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what more to say. So my upbringing was somewhat different than a typical white upbringing. The Communist Party was integrated, mm-hmm. If you can say it that way. I had black friends who were, the children of other party members.
Okay.
They would go to a meeting, they'd bring the kids, we'd play out in the backyard, and they would do whatever it was they were doing. Paul Robeson had dinner at our house.
Wow.
So to me that was the norm. However you grow up as a kid, that's the normal thing.
Okay.
Went to summer camp, commie camp, and but basically other than that I was just an ordinary kid, and except when we would get harassed or something.
So what, your parents, how did they get involved in this? I mean, what were your parents' names, first of all, and where were they from?
Ken and Claire.
Ken and Claire.
All right, this is going to be a long interview. My father was a Kentucky hillbilly.
Okay.
He grew from the hills. He managed, I think he had a sixth grade education.
Okay.
Became a telegraph operator. During the Depression, the conditions were oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
He heard about a union. He was in Cincinnati by then. Started a union and
for telegraph
which
operators.
Eventually evolved into what is now today the CWA.
Okay.
Became a union organizer. My mother was from Brooklyn.
Hmm.
She was dating a guy and they were sort of liberal, but his sister was challenging her. Oh, what about the Scottsboro boys? What about this? What about the... And my mother knew nothing about this and said, oh, well, I better study up on this.
Okay.
And from there, and then she ended up, she was actually the highest ranking woman organizer, paid staff in the CIO.
Okay.
And... went toe-to-toe with Roosevelt at Hyde Park, and, there are a lot of stories, but if we go off onto that.
Okay, so what was some of the most important things that they taught you growing up that you remember? I guess,
That's hard to say. It was more just the acculturation.
Okay.
The party had a rule,
mm-hmm.
and they were very rigid, that the parents were not allowed to tell the children what they were doing.
Okay.
For fear that the children would tell some other child and then it would get back to the FBI. So they never told me all of what they were doing. I had to just kind of sense it.
Okay.
You know, and so there was a time we during the period where they were trying to deport foreign-born, who were citizens, but they were radicals, so they were trying to... We had people hiding in our cellar. And I had to go answer the door when the FBI knocked because, you know, they couldn't interrogate a child.
Right.
And then, so I'm being told to go out and tell the FBI my parents are not home, and not to mention I got people hiding in the cellar, but they wouldn't tell me why.
I mean, so what were you thinking? I mean,
this is your family. This is what we do. You know, you don't question when you're a kid.
Okay.
So I knew stuff was going on, but it was hidden. It was secret. And you know, when your parents don't want you to know, you know that, mm-hmm. and you don't challenge that until you get a certain age.
Yeah, that was the next question.
Well, by the time I got to the rebellious youth age, they were out of the party. They had left the party.
Okay.
After the revelations of what had actually... See, they believed the myth of what was going on in the Soviet Union. When they found out the reality, they got out.
Right.
So, and in some ways, they felt betrayed, and they were betrayed by the party. So by the time I became a rebellious youth, they still had the values, but they weren't politically that active anymore.
Okay. So how did it play out? I mean, in high school, did you get in trouble? What were your schooling years like? And where did
horrendous.
You attend
school? I went to school in Los Angeles at Dorsey High School.
Okay.
And Dorsey was a marvelously integrated high school. Quarter white, a quarter black, a quarter Asian, and a quarter, we called them Mexican then, but now we would say Latino. And the buildings were arranged in where there were open triangles of open space. And each race seized the triangle. And if you were the other race and you went into their triangle, you got beat up. I, unfortunately or fortunately, was Jewish on my mother's side. We didn't have a triangle, and the white kids didn't consider Jews as to be really white. I mean, sort of white, but not totally white. So I didn't have a triangle. So I did not have a good time in high school.
Okay. Do you remember any of your teachers there?
Not really.
Not really.
Not really. I was of the school. I hated and loathed every minute of school. I barely scraped by with the C average. Okay. I was not an intellectual. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I did a lot of reading. I educated myself in spite of the Los Angeles City School System.
Okay.
It's not a good... I don't have good memories there.
Okay. I guess the other question that I was going to ask is, you said you read on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Were there books around the house that your parents where did you get your books, and how did you seek that knowledge out, that information out?
Oh well, my parents, huge readers. Okay. So there was that. I went to the library. You know, I got a paper route. I bought my own books. You know, but I didn't really start reading political books until I was in the movement.
Okay,
it went that way rather than read the books and then get active.
Okay. So you graduate from high school, what year?
59, 60, something like
okay.
that.
Okay, and so what next? Where do you head after?
I went to college. I couldn't get into a real college, so I went to what we called a junior college. Today they're called community colleges, because junior, doesn't sound so good. Had no idea what I was doing with my life. Bored. Just hanging.
Mm-hmm.
Went to a coffee house. Oh, the one readings that I did do was on the Holocaust.
Okay.
And, you know, I was deep into studying that and very, very angry. Not just at what the Germans and the Nazis did, of course, but as angry or angrier at the American government and all those who allowed that to happen without lifting a finger to save the Jews and to oppose them. And I called myself, I don't know if you're familiar, but they're all, just like in Christianity, you have different, groups like Baptists and Lutherans.
Denominations,
that's the word. There are different denominations in Judaism, liberal, conservative, Reconstructionist. And, people say, well, what are you? So I made up my own denomination. I said I was a four nevers Jew. Never again, never forget, never forgive, and never stand by while other people are persecuted the way they stood by while we were persecuted.
Okay. Right.
Now, the relevance of this is I was hanging around in a coffee house, not like a Starbucks. This was a beatnik coffee house.
Right.
And they said, oh, we're going to show some movies of the CORE open housing demonstration. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what a CORE was. It turned out to be the Congress of Racial Equality. And I didn't know what open housing was, but I was bored, so okay. And they were picketing a white-only housing tract that would only sell to whites. Housing segregation in California in general, and Los Angeles in particular, was very total. I mean, it was extreme. And so they're showing these movies. Well, there was the American Nazi Party was counter-attacking the CORE pickets. Mm. And these are Nazis in full uniform, swastikas, the hats, the Sieg Heil, the kill the Jews, send the niggers back to Africa. I said, fuck it. If you're against the Nazis, I'm with you. When is your next? I'm going. You tell me. Went out there. There was 12 of us picketing. There was 30 or 40 Nazis attacking us. I said, all right, you against the Nazis. Anytime you call me. And I became a full-time CORE activist.
Wow.
And after a while, we outnumbered the Nazis, and they dwindled away, but I stayed in the movement.
It's just stories you don't hear about Nazis protesting in America.
No, but this was 1963. And they were throwing stuff at us, and the cops were laughing, and, it was... the cops sided with the Nazis. Actually, it turned out I preferred the Nazis to the L.A. Police Department because at least the Nazis were honest about it.
You knew where they stood, right?
They made no bones about it. But the cops, when I was in jail, the Lincoln Heights jail, and they marched us, by the admitting sergeant, and we saw on his desk Klan literature.
Wow.
So
you said CORE focused on housing issues in Los Angeles.
And employment. De facto school segregation. Those were the three CORE issues. Employment, housing, and school segregation.
Okay, do you remember something about the people who sort of pulled you in? What were some of the
figures?
Well,
yeah. One of the main guys who really got me involved is Woodrow Coleman, and he's wandering around here. I just met him after 40 years or 50 years. Just saw him yesterday, and mm-hmm. he's here at this conference.
And I bet they brought back all types.
We had some times.
So, as an organizer, what was he like?
He was your basic grassroots, up from the people, salt of the earth. He was a hod carrier. That's okay. Like a construction laborer. Mm-hmm. A union man, mm-hmm. but no great education. Mm-hmm. But he had courage. He had charisma. He had dignity. He was the example we tried to live up to.
Okay.
So, but by the way, I did work in the South. I know this is the Southern oral history.
Yeah, we're going to get to that.
All right.
So this is 1963.
1963.
Yeah. So, I guess.
Well, the next thing that happened. All right. So this is 1963. I'm going to all these protests, but I'm not getting arrested. Mm-hmm. Because my parents, the revolutionary communists, mm-hmm. ex-communists, but still, they were, oh, Bruce, what you're doing is wonderful. We think all the civil rights is great. But what you should do is get your degree, and then you'll really be able to help, but you'll be safe. You'll have a profession. And you won't lose your... Neither of my parents had college at all.
Right.
And they were always being fired because the FBI would come around and say, fire these people. And they figured if you had a college degree, you were safe.
Right.
Talk about ignorance. So they kept trying... Don't do... So this influence was still strong on to me. Mm-hmm. I was 19. And so I didn't get... I was afraid to get arrested. So then I went to the March on Washington.
Okay.
And it had an enormous effect on me. Within a month after returning from the march on Washington, I've been arrested twice. And after that, I was a regular customer of the judicial system. I was one of their best customers.
Well, you couldn't get rid of that record after the first couple of arrests, so.
Yeah, and it turned out had no meaning to my life at all. I think probably I got, counting the South and everything, maybe arrested 15 times would be my guess. It's hard to know sometimes whether you're officially arrested or they're just, fucking with you. Can I say that? Okay.
That's up to you.
You can bleep it out. But I have never, ever had that effect. I never would apply at a place for a job where I knew that would be an issue.
Right.
And I never had any trouble finding a job otherwise. It never had any effect on me at all.
So your trek across from California to the March on Washington, how did that, did you go by yourself? Was there a group of people?
As it turned out, my parents, just my last semester in high school, my father got a job in the East. They moved East. I stayed in California. Okay. Parents are so sweet. They always wanted to see me. So around the time of the March on Washington, I said, if you want to send me a ticket, I'll be happy to come to Connecticut.
Right.
But I'm going to go to the march. I mean, I didn't lie to them about that. They said, oh, great, great, great. So they flew me to Connecticut, and I actually took a bus down from New Haven that had been chartered by New Haven Corps.
Okay.
So it wasn't a trek across the country for me.
So after the March on Washington, did you get more involved in Corps? This was in. Did you stay in Connecticut? Did you go back out?
No, this was back in LA. And
okay.
We Woody Coleman and several. We were the Action Faction.
Okay.
I was part of the Action Faction. Felt the Corps wasn't militant enough.
Okay.
And so we formed the Nonviolent Action Committee, which was really going to be militant, but okay. Nonviolent. So I was working with both the NVAC, which is what we call Nonviolent Action Committee, and then I started working with, somehow I graduated junior college, and somehow I got into UCLA.
Wow, okay.
And so I was working with the Bruin Corps, the UCLA campus chapter of Corps. And it took them a whole year to flunk me out. And this was, talk about oppression.
Mm-hmm.
They flunked me out, and the only reason they had to flunk me out was that I never attended classes, I never took any of the tests, I never wrote any of the papers, and I never did anything else they wanted me to do. But I was getting a tremendous education in the movement.
Right.
So, but they took these excuses. He never took his tests, he never wrote his papers, he never attended classes, and they flunked me out for that. But I'll tell you, I learned far more in the movement than I ever would have in those classes. So I count myself fortunate that I was one of the lucky ones who never went to class. Now, I know you probably are college, I'm subverting in your life. Don't take anything I say seriously, because otherwise you'll get in trouble.
It won't work today.
Well, it might, but it worked for me.
So what were some of the things that CORE on UCLA's campus focused on? What were some of the things?
Just the same thing.
Same thing.
At that time, we had this big campaign going against the Bank of America.
Okay.
You would walk into any bank in any city in the country, and everyone working there, with the possible exception of the janitor, was white. They would not hire blacks, Latinos, or Asians.
Right.
And we had this campaign, and we were victorious.
Okay.
And we got them to integrate. And today, you walk into a bank, it looks like everything else.
Right.
So that was the big thing we were. Oh, and then the de facto school segregation. Los Angeles was so cold.
Mm-hmm.
They had a big. There was a street called Alameda. Ran 10 miles north and south.
Mm-hmm.
On the west side of the street. All black.
Mm-hmm.
You could fire a missile, and it would be 10 minutes before it passed over any white people. And on the east side of the street, all white.
Mm-hmm.
And the schools, because it was a big wide street with a railroad running down it, mm-hmm. so the land was cheap. Right. So the schools were checkerboarded down, up and down, right? Strip. But the school district ran down Alameda Street. So here you have the line of the school boundary, and the school is right on the boundary. So that the schools on the west side of the street were all black.
Right.
On the east side of the street were all white. So I mean, that was, it was just so blatant, you couldn't believe it. So yeah, those we had sit-ins and mm-hmm. marches and boycotts, and you know, we did coin-ins at the bank, and you know, all kinds of stuff.
Any moments that were more interesting that you like to share?
Oh. No, unless this.
Okay, so how did you end up in the South? I mean, this is what, 64, 65 now?
Yeah, well, early 65, I forget why I needed to leave. Oh, NVAC basically got serious. We had so many court cases, it just crippled us. And I decided I was ready to go south, and I wrote to SNCC and SCLC, and SNCC was at that point moving away from having white staff, mm-hmm. and SCLC was, you know, never went that direction.
So this is 66?
No, this is 65, this is early 65. So a few days after Bloody Sunday, I was in Selma, and then I was put on the SCLC field staff.
Okay. Who were you working with at SLC? Do you remember?
Well, in Selma, you know, Bevel was the James Bevel was the main guy. But then, after the Selma campaign, I guess Bevel started planning the Chicago campaign. Anyway, mm-hmm. I ended up under Hosea Williams.
Okay.
And then, so I had worked in, I worked in Dallas County mm-hmm. and Dallas County and then Crenshaw County.
Okay.
And then Marengo and Hale County. And then I had to go back to California to serve a sentence mm-hmm. for a sit-in. And
how long?
I served 30 days mm-hmm. on the Wayside Honor Farm, a ranch, the Wayside Honor Ranch.
Honor Ranch?
Okay. Yes, the Honor Ranch. Other places would call it the prison farm, mm-hmm. but in L.A. it was the Honor Ranch.
Because it's an honor to be there.
And because it was an honor to be there, yes. And so I served 30 days there, and I tried to go back to school a little, but that mm-hmm. didn't work out. So then in the spring of 66, so that was, you know, like the winter, you know, I don't know, couple of the winter months, 65. Okay. Spring of 66, I was back in Hale County, Alabama, where we had the first black candidates running for office. Mm-hmm. And then I was around there. And then the Meredith March in 66, okay. I went on that. And then I was assigned to Grenada, Mississippi, where I was there from July of 66 to February of 67.
Okay.
And nobody knows about the Grenada movement, but it was a big movement.
Yeah, let's get back and talk to that, but I want to back up first and talk a little bit about your, when you came south, what was your reaction? What did you think? I mean, had you traveled in the south before? Especially coming from a big place like Los Angeles.
Never been to the south in my life. Mm-hmm. What was my reaction to the south? Well, that's a good question. I'd been 2 years now in the movement, so I knew what was going on in the South. I mean, you know, Well, the Corps had its, you know, news operation. Freedom Singers would come to California. I was friends of SNCC. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the political aspects of what was going on was no surprise to me, and I knew what to expect. The horrendous poverty mm-hmm. I was, wasn't prepared for.
Okay.
The sharecroppers. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, it's hard to imagine. Now, are you from the South?
Yes, I'm from Charlotte.
Okay. You're from Charlotte, okay. The thing that's, you would drive along the roads and you would see these sharecropper shacks mm-hmm. of just abject poverty mm-hmm. and starvation and hunger mm-hmm. and children, babies, so weak as they lie there, they can't brush the flies out of their eyes, right? And that was very striking. So I come back to the South. I came back for the 40th anniversary of the Selma March of 5 years ago, 2005. And I'm driving around in all these rural places where we're, and there are no, those shacks are all gone. Mm. And I'm saying, wow, this is great. This poverty has been alleviated. Mm. And then I dig a little deeper because I do research, and I realize, oh no, that's not what happened. All those people were pushed out. And they all migrated to the inner cities where they're the homeless of the inner cities. But you know, nowadays you drive the country roads in North Carolina or Alabama, Mississippi, and see a lot of snug brick homes, right, and, you know, nice trailers and whatever. Even the white sharecroppers, was poor. So that poverty really... The poverty stunned me, and then coming back decades later, seeing the difference. Mm-hmm. You know, people say, well, what did the civil rights movement accomplish? Mm-hmm. And obviously it accomplished a great deal. But in the economic sphere, the biggest beneficiaries economically of the civil rights movement were white Southerners. Because now you have all of these franchise businesses, all of these shopping malls, right, and it's mostly white-owned. Mm-hmm. It's mostly white employees. The poverty of black communities is still really noticeably poorer than the white communities. It's somewhat up from what it was in sharecropper days. Mm-hmm. But it was the whites who were so vicious in opposing the civil rights movement, they turned out to be some of the biggest beneficiaries. Wow. The civil rights movement, before the civil rights movement, the South was what we now call an underdeveloped nation. It was like a colony, mm-hmm, of the North. And now it's been brought into, it's now part of the United States to the benefit of the white Mississippians.
Industrialized, right. So I guess when you first got to Mississippi, what was your responsibilities?
Alabama,
I'm sorry.
Well, because I had been with CORE, and I had done nonviolent,
right,
training for CORE, they had me doing nonviolent training, okay, in Selma. And then when I was in Crenshaw, mm-hmm, that was a voter registration project.
Okay.
In Hale County, we were trying to elect the first black sheriff.
Okay.
Which we did not. Mm. And then in Grenada was pretty much everything.
Mm. So talk about Grenada a little bit.
Oh, Grenada. Grenada never got the attention that the previous major focuses like Albany, Birmingham, mm-hmm, St. Augustine. Partly, I think, mostly because of the timing.
Okay.
This was now 66. The Voting Rights Act had passed. The Civil Rights Act had passed. The focus was on the urban uprisings in the North, the King's Chicago. But Grenada was one of the longest running mass movements on an Albany, Birmingham scale.
Right.
Tiny little town. I mean, a real pit. And vicious, mm-hmm, vicious racism.
Examples of, like, what are some examples that you...
Well, when the Meredith March came through... Well, first of all, Grenada, even during Freedom Summer, 2 years earlier, they hadn't gone into Grenada.
Okay.
It was considered one of the places too dangerous.
Just don't
go. Don't try a project in Grenada. Nobody would be willing to even sponsor it, you know.
Right.
The march comes through, and the black community has this enormous response. You know, it was like a lid had been taken off a pressure cooker. Mm. The Grenada white power structure, they had a plan. And they told the press, we know they had a plan because they bragged about it to Jack Nelson of the LA Times. And their plan was, we will not give them any. We'll ease the march through town. We'll register people. We won't give them any excuse to do anything, and we'll get them out of town as quietly as possible. Mm-hmm. And, but they were not ready. You know, they figured, all right, 20 people try and register to vote, big deal. You know, like hundreds came right. out. So anyway, but they did manage to ease the march out of town. And then it turned out that they had played a trick. That the people who, and they had registered 100 or 200 people, a couple hundred, they weren't really registered. They played a game on
right.
them. So, I mean, that was just so typical.
When did they find out about that?
They found out a couple weeks later. Yeah, people okay. found out, and there was a, you know, people were demoralized. But SCLC, the people had said, look, please come back. Mm-hmm. And SCLC had committed to coming back to Grenada. So once the march was over, staff workers came back.
Okay.
And then and we rebuilt the movement from that demoralization. Mm. But this is now 66, right?
Yeah.
So there's a court order. We did legal stuff too. And there was a court order to desegregate the school system, which, of course, totally white, totally black.
Mm-hmm.
And because the movement was strong, the court order was that black parents could sign up to send their children to the white school. They could. That's all I had to do was say, I want to go there. Mm-hmm. I want my children to go there. 450 black children registered in the white elementary and high school, and I don't think they had a junior high. I think it right. just was elementary and high school. Well, at this time, even in 66, mm-hmm. an integrated white school in Mississippi meant that there were four black girls and maybe one black boy.
Right.
Maybe not even that black boy.
Right.
But, you know, and that was big integration. Mm-hmm. 450. So they freaked. Mm-hmm. They totally freaked. The first day of school, there was the Klan had mobilized from all over Mississippi to come to Grenada. Mm-hmm. They had 400 or 500 white men with clubs and chains beating the children, even the little grade school children.
Are you serious?
I am serious. They had pickup trucks with walkie-talkies saying, all right, there's a group coming up Pearl Street. Oh, send the mob over to this street. There's a car trying to get through, you know, with bringing their children to school. And they brutalized. Hundreds of men were attacking with axe handles school children. And the police were just, oh, hey, George, you know, just standing by. Oh, the police helped beat up the reporters. Hmm. That was their job. And attack the news, the TV people. So it turned out that one of the organizers of this mob was the local judge, who was the judge who would sentence us for our sit-in arrests and stuff. So that was Grenada. They would mobilize to a. We would every night we would have a march from Bellflower Baptist Church
okay.
up to the town square, which was one of these town squares, you know, with a Confederate. When the march came through, when the Meredith March came through, mm. One of the SCLC people put an American flag okay. on the Confederate soldier statue. Mm-hmm. And the white in Grenada, that was a desecration. That was the word they used, desecration, to put an American flag on a statue in the town square of an American town. But to them, it was a desecration. It was like we had raped a nun or something. So they would mobilize these mobs to attack our demonstration. And we would, you know, sometimes, we usually had somewhere between 100 and 300 marchers, mm-hmm. and they sometimes would have 500 to 1,000, you know, people, you know, mm-hmm. And, you know, we had to use nonviolent tactics to survive and to keep the things going, but we did.
Who were some of the local people that you got involved? Do you remember local?
The minister at Bellflower Baptist Church was the main guy, and I'll call his name as soon as it gets to my brain. So he was the main one. I didn't work very closely with the local leadership because I was working, you know, like canvassing and things. SCLC had a large project, and so there was usually 10 to 20 organizers there. And our project directors were the ones who worked mostly with the local leaders.
Okay, you mentioned that children were being beaten. So I imagine that was there a large involvement from the children locally?
Oh yeah, well as usual, it was the youth who did the march, the youth and the women, and one or two ministers in the lead. And behind them was all children and women. Interestingly enough, one of the children who was beaten and severely injured that day later became the mayor of Grenada.
Wow.
But, well, there were two white candidates who fought each other, and she slipped in with less than a majority, because Grenada is not a majority black county. And of course they did everything then to sabotage her term and got rid of her as soon as the next election was. But even so.
Divine retribution.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess on a whole, how did you view the campaign in Grenada after you left? What were you able to accomplish?
The movement accomplished. Remember, we were just facilitators. The movement was from the people. And we brought certain skills, and we brought, you know, ability to connect with the outside world. But the movement was their movement. And what they accomplished was they changed a culture of oppression to a culture of resistance. They said no. They changed. It didn't happen overnight, but they changed the whole social dynamics. Economically, not so much. But in terms of the whole way in which people and the races related, total change. Voter registration, which would then affect, you know, the elections and so forth. And, you know, it used to be... We never had any difficulty knowing which was the black community and which was the white community, because the black community roads were all mud and no pavement and no street lights and no sidewalks, and the whites were the opposite. And now that's, you know, they got their streets paved and so forth.
Okay. Did you spend, now the majority of your time in the South, was it spent in Grenada?
Well, actually, almost a little bit under half, because I spent probably a total of more time in Alabama, in Selma, in Crenshaw County, Hale County.
Okay, so when you got ready to leave, when you were winding down and decided what was the next move, how did you come to that?
Well, I just was forced out by health. You wouldn't know it now, but I was known as the skinny kid. And I was down to like 130 pounds. Couldn't eat, you know, ulcers, you know, just because of the tension and the violence. And so I had to get out just because I was worn down.
Okay.
And, you know, so then I left.
Where'd you go after that?
I went back to Connecticut for a little while. Some of the SCLC people, Bevel and Bernard Lafayette, were organizing the first mass protest against the Vietnam War in New York City, and they asked me to help organize with that. I did that. And then the next fall, I went to San Francisco State, where I became a student activist, SDS, and then we ended up having the longest student strike in American history for... Third World Studies.
And,
I was involved in that.
Okay. So you remain active.
Oh, yeah.
And you could still consider yourself an activist.
Yeah, last month I was on big demonstrations in California to defend public education.
Wow, okay.
So, which you guys will soon be having here.
So
I hope.
I guess so. I mean, looking back, you've shared a lot of your just reflections about it. I mean, is there anything that you feel that hasn't been said here that needs to be said? Or I mean, you spoke about Grenada, which was an event that not a lot of people know about. But
actually, I posted a chronology of the Grenada movement on the Civil Rights Veterans website.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I am.
Okay. So you can
check it out.
Check that out. People talk, how can I say this? Living in California, living in San Francisco, I've encountered people who have had drug problems. Is that the problem?
No.
I've had friends who became addicted to heroin and meth and stuff like that. There is no drug as addictive as being part of a people's mass movement for freedom.
Wow.
Once I hit Selma, I was addicted to that drug. And I have been for a people's mass movement, searching for that fix ever since. You do not forget it. Mm. And it was the most powerful, euphoric drug for me personally that I have ever, and I've tried them all. I've tried them all. And that's the only one that I'm addicted to. Because there's something about, the books and the official, Martin Luther King, who I loved and admired, that wasn't, the real movement was the movement of the people from below. It was a movement from below. It was not a top-down movement.
Right.
And this is something that the media and the textbooks continually miss. But there was something so powerful about that, and so American about that it stuck with me ever since. So.
I guess I have a few questions, but some of them that I have, I'll write them off and see if you feel like getting into this stuff, and then if you do, we can continue. So one of them was some nitty-gritty stuff, because I do a lot of organizing myself, so I'm really curious about some of these things, like how you dealt with court cases. You said you had, you were so inundated with court cases at a certain point that you had to just leave or whatever. So that's one question. Then I'd like to ask what the nonviolent training consisted of. The workshops that you conducted, if that's the way you understood it. What the participation in the San Francisco State student strike looked like that whole thing, because that's an interesting thing from the 70s.
No,
68.
Late 60s. Okay. Late 60s. The 67-68 term.
Was the push for African-American studies all surrounding that.
So those would be the questions that I would ask, and that might take another 20 minutes or so to cover. Would that be cool?
Yeah, except that I hope I don't miss lunch. But yeah, sure. Let's. The court cases isn't an interesting question.
We just
spend in terms of the court cases. The reason it sort of really sagged NVAC for a while is that we spent every day in court, and we couldn't do anything else.
Right.
And some of these trials went on for 4, 6, 8 weeks. Not for the trial, but to select the jury. So we were just exhausted sitting around the court.
Okay.
What was the other question? Yeah.
The other question was, you mentioned that you did workshops on nonviolent training.
Right.
Yeah. So what do those workshops look like in practice?
Okay, well, the workshops I ran were from the point of view of tactical nonviolence, not philosophic nonviolence. So we talked very little about the philosophy of nonviolence. And basically it was how to be a protester, how to march, how to sit in, how to picket, how to defend yourself against attack, how to giving training in how to remain cool when people are screaming racist insults right. into your face and pouring stuff on you and hitting you. And we would practice that, you know, and it was very different. I had been used to doing these trainings for people in California, where it's very hard to get those who are playing the role of the attacker mm-hmm. to actually attack people. Oh, no, I can't hit anybody. And, you know, so that we always had to say, okay, now you really got to do this, this, you know, and you'll have your turn on the other, you know, side and so forth. So, we would practice. What do you do when you're hit? How do you, nonviolently protect yourself and protect other people? So the first training session I did in Selma, I was working with the junior high school kids, from Selma. And I said, okay, now we're going to role play, you know, how do you do when they hit you? And I said to a girl, I don't know, she must have been 15 or something like that. I said to her, okay, now you come up and slug me. Mm-hmm. She said, oh, are you sure about, you know? She said, no, I really want, you know, really. And so I go into the spiel, you know, about, you know, you really get to do it the way I would do in California. Mm-hmm. She, this big light came over her face, and she hauled off, and she slugged me and knocked me across the room. And I slid across the wood floor, and I still have a scar on my shoulder back here where it cut my... After that, I didn't stress the hitting so much. Nonviolent training in how to survive and how to organize a picket line, how to do a sit-in, mm-hmm. how to be a march marshal, you know, and a little bit on the philosophy, but mostly it was, you know, we're doing this because this is the way to win.
Right.
We're doing this because this is the way to keep our discipline. Oh, and discipline.
Right.
That was an important thing, which nobody pays any attention to now, but discipline was crucial to not only survival, but political effectiveness. Mm-hmm. Everybody, counterposes nonviolence over here, Malcolm X over there, because he spoke against nonviolence. He was mostly nonviolent, mm-hmm. Without the rhetoric. I'm sure you've seen the movie with Denzel Washington, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene in there, I believe, I knew about this, so maybe I'm putting it onto the movie, but I think it's in the movie, where one of the most powerful things Malcolm ever did was after an incident of police brutality in Harlem, mm-hmm. he organized the nation. They went out and they stood in front of the police department in orderly ranks, mm-hmm. organized, silent, completely nonviolent and completely, totally freaked out the police. Why? Because of the discipline. Mm-hmm. And that the discipline of the nonviolent protesters was what gave our message its political power. Mm-hmm. And Malcolm used the same thing. I'm not criticizing him in any way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just pointing out that tactical nonviolence was essentially, we all had to do it. No matter how you felt.
Right.
There was, in one two-month period in Alabama, the Klan tried to kill me 4 times.
Wow.
Twice I used nonviolent tactics to survive. Once we fled and they chased us across half a county, and once we fired back. That was, because that was what the situation was.
Mm-hmm.
So, nonviolent tactics, run like hell, fire back, as according to the tactical necessities.
Right.
So I was not a philosophical nonviolent person, but I am a strong proponent of the power and effectiveness of tactical nonviolence. Did that answer your question, or did I go off ranting into?
No, that was good.
It helps a lot. Yeah, definitely. The last thing I'll ask, just to get a quick question out there, is this: you mentioned your involvement in the San Francisco State student strike.
Uh huh.
So if you could go into that a little bit.
Well, I don't know. What do you want to know about it?
What was it about, I guess? How did it develop? How did you... You ended up winning, more or less, what you
pretty
were
much
asking for. So,
well, those... see, the thing is, in these movements, we always ask for what we want. We never got what we wanted. So it always felt somewhat like a defeat, even though mm-hmm. it really was a victory. You know, so we sometimes didn't acknowledge our own victories. But the state strike grew out of 2 years of organizing, initially by the Black Student Union, and then to a lesser extent by SDS, which I was active with. And the demands were for a Third World Studies department, which would have a school of Black Studies, a school of Latino Studies, Chicano Studies is what we called it then, you know, and schools for different ethnic groups, and you could get a degree in it. And this was the longest student strike, most effective student strike in U.S. history. It started in the fall, I think it was in October, and we basically held that strike until January or February. There were, I think, 900 people arrested, or 600, something like that. But it was effective because of the years of organizing that preceded it, and because it was not just a student strike. That they had, particularly the Black Student Union, had been working in the community with tutorial programs. And we brought in, support from the community. And so you had people like Ron Dellums, who later became a well-known congressman. He was a city councilman in Berkeley. He's leading a march of Berkeley people across the campus in our support. Willie Brown, who became the Speaker of the House of California and then the mayor of San Francisco. He was, a very small politician at that time. He came, you know, with community people and church people. And because they were not successful in isolating us from the community, and the radical nutcases in our ranks were not successful in isolating us from the community, we won that strike. So, yeah. And in some ways, it was familiar territory. I mean, they had the police and the cavalry. I mean, literally the cavalry, horses, you know, there on the campus, and hundreds of cops and, you know, all the stuff. Okay?
That's good.
Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Hartford. Thank you for your time.